Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on homedepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at homedepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code bedbath15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit homedepot.com for more information.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and fostering. Today, we're going to be talking about therapeutic parenting. This is a topic I love. It's talking with the author of a new book, Therapeutic Parenting. The author is Sarah Naish. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
The reality is that neglect causes the most severe brain damage because the brain can't grow and build synapses in the same way as a child who is not neglected. So in actual fact, they can't make sense of the world. So if a child is neglected for the first 2 years of life and they've got no frame of reference, we say that their internal working model, the whole way they interpret the world, is skewed. And that takes a very long time to sort out.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Foster Care Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host and the director of Creating a Family. And you can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. Their mission is to strengthen adoptive families through post-adoption services. As their founder, Deborah Waller, who is the chairman and CEO of Jockey International, says, one failed adoption is one too many. You can support their mission by buying a bear or a blanket at jockeybeingfamily.com, and we thank them for their support. As I mentioned, this show is underwritten by Jockey Being Family, but it is also supported by our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, accurate information and support to pre- and post-adoptive families and foster families. One of our wonderful partners is Adoptions from Shepherd Care. They are a nonprofit adoption agency founded in 1980. They provide domestic infant adoption, international adoption from Colombia, and domestic and Hague-approved international adoption home studies. Today, we're going to be talking about therapeutic parenting, and we're going to be talking with Sarah Naish. She is a therapeutic parent of 5 adopted children. She is the founder and CEO of the National Association of Therapeutic Parents. She is also the managing director of Inspire Training Group in the UK. And most important for our discussion today, she is the author of a book, The A to Z of Therapeutic Parenting, Strategies and Solutions. Welcome, Sarah, to Creating a Family. I am so looking forward to this interview.
Thank you, Dawn. Thank you. Hi.
You know, I love this book. I will just say that at the beginning. I really enjoyed the book, The A to Z of Therapeutic Parenting. I think what I enjoyed most about it, as you can imagine, I read a lot on this subject. I read a lot of the books on this subject. I might even say I read most of the books that have been published on this subject. and what I particularly liked is the second half of the book, which is the A to Z part. I like the first part. It plays to where I'm fascinated, and that is the understanding the underlying principles and the research and stuff like that. That is something I absolutely like and spend my time in just because it's where my natural inclinations are. But the second half of the book, to me, is where the real jewel lies because you've taken very specific situations and applied what all the theory and gave us suggestions of what to do specifically when the situation is happening and then afterwards. So anyway, just because I can't help myself, we're going to have to talk some about the, at the beginning, about some of the underlying stuff. It's just who I am. So let's start with a therapeutic parenting. What is it? How do you define it? What is it? And who is it used for?
Well, I mean, I have got several kind of real definitions of therapeutic parenting, but we always think of it as a deeply nurturing form of parenting based in empathy. But importantly, also, we have very strong boundaries and routine as well. And I think sometimes that gets left behind and people forget about that bit. But yeah, lots of empathy and nurture, but very clear routine and structure.
Yeah, and I agree. And I would just also throw in that although we are speaking of its application for children who have been adopted and children who have are in you're fostering through foster care, it can also be applied for any child who has experienced trauma. It really is a trauma-based approach.
Yes.
So I think
yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the
yeah.
And speaking of that, we did receive a question from Mary Lynn. She said, I have been surprised by the degree of behavior problems my foster son has. He is 7 and was removed at age 5 because of neglect. I am his only foster placement, and he has been with me for 1.5 years. I thought that since he was only neglected and not abused, he would have fewer issues. Let's talk just briefly, and this kind of goes back to the heart of trauma. What are some of the distinctions you see? I mean, was that realistic of Mary Lynn to think that the abused child is going to have less issues than, the opposite, that a neglected child will have less issues than an abused child?
Yeah, it's an interesting misconception. And in the UK, I often hear social workers saying things like, he was only neglected. The reality is that neglect causes the most severe brain damage because the brain can't grow and build synapses in the same way as a child who is not neglected. So in actual fact, they can't make sense of the world. So if a child is neglected for the first 2 years of life and they've got no frame of reference, we say that their internal working model, the whole way they interpret the world is skewed. And that takes a very long time to sort out. So neglect causes severe damage to our children, and it takes a very long time to help them to link cause and effect and overcome some of the things that have happened or the way they've interpreted the world.
All right, so your approach to therapeutic parenting, you start with saying that one of the first things we need to do is understand the cause of the child's behavior. And then I'm going to go ahead and say the second part just so people have that in mind. And the second part is establishing structure and firm boundaries, which you mentioned earlier. So let's start with understanding the cause of our kids' behaviors. Why do our kids behave the way they do? And you list a number of things, but the first thing you say is we have to understand that most of their behavior is fear-based. I got to tell you, sometimes it doesn't look fear-based. It just looks rude or aggressive or obnoxious or something. So talk to me about the fear base, even when I don't notice that.
Okay. Well, for example, my eldest daughter, she looked very defiant and rude. Well, she was. She acted in a very defiant way, very rude way. And the reason for that was because she was so frightened of getting close to anyone, of letting any adults close to her. So one of the things that I've said in the book and I say in my training is that, you know, if you're scared of spiders, you don't care if it's a good spider. You know, it's just a spider that you're scared of. So our children often, sadly, what has caused their fear is what should have been their caregivers. So now they're in our home and they're with new foster parents or adopters, but they're still adults. So if the adult was the source of fear or pain to the child, then you are another adult. So my daughter was acting in a rude, defiant way to keep me, the adult, away from her. She didn't want to connect and she didn't want me to get close to her, keep me away. So she did that by being rude and rejecting and running away and all those kinds of things. But as an adult now, she would say, you know, that's fear-based, frightened of adults, frightened of getting close. But you're right, it doesn't look like that sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You know, we talked in the, again, in the first part of the book, you talk about some of the things our children who have experienced trauma lack, and that influences how they behave. And one of the ones you just mentioned is the lack of ability to trust adults. Adults have caused often of pain in their world, both physical or emotional. So another lack is a lack of cause and effect thinking. I think I know what cause and effect thinking is, but why do our children lack it? They certainly do, but why?
Well, I think that, for example, if you think of a child who's in a crib and they are hungry, how does that child learn that they're hungry? Well, normally it would be because they would cry. A parent would come along and interpret what was wrong with the child. They might cuddle them. They might change them. They might give them some food. And then they give them some food and the child stops crying. So they therefore interpreted that, you know, the child was hungry. And then they will say to the child, oh, you were hungry. Oh, you know, here's... So the child only learns what hunger is by the response of the caregiver. Now, if, like my children, they were left in a place where they cried and nobody came, it means that their cry has no effect. So they don't learn even that crying has an effect and brings a caregiver. So, and then they also learn that this feeling I've got in my tummy, they're not learning to interpret that as hunger because they're not having food given at the right time, so they don't know that having food makes it better. So that's just two really simple examples of how suddenly our children can't link cause and effect because what they are doing is not having an impact on the world.
And the and if you can't, it's not that you won't think of the effect of your actions. If you can't think of the effect of your actions, it absolutely impacts what you do or how our children behave.
Yes.
Another lack that you talk of is empathy. So how do children become empathetic?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, I always say at our training that you have to give that one 10 years. I think sometimes people think it's going to come along very early on. I think our children can get very skilled at modelling empathy. They can see how people around them are behaving and they know that if something sad has happened, they may be able to express sadness. It doesn't mean that they feel it. One of the ways that I could see it was developing was through the cause and effect thinking, actually, because if you think about it, when a child does something without any concern about what's going to happen to them in the future, this means that they lack empathy for their own self, for their future self, if you like. So if they don't even care what's going to happen to them in the future, we can't expect them to have empathy for ourselves or for us. Excuse me. So that's how one of the ways that we develop empathy. We see the children beginning to feel, excuse me, I'm sorry, see,
it's okay.
Begin to feel a little bit sorry that they something bad might happen to them. So, for example, a good example of that is when my son was 15, he would steal. And he would steal from in front of a camera. So anybody else would say, well, he would know that I would see the camera later on, I'd play it back, and I would see that he had taken the money. But in that moment, he's living in now. He's not thinking of his future self. So he's just taking that money because his now self wants that now. I could tell that he was developing empathy when that started restricting his own behaviour, when he thought, hang on a minute, if I do that, Mum's going to be cross. So that's the first signs we see of empathy is when they're starting to think about how it might affect them in the future.
Well, and cause and effect thinking and empathy as well, but especially cause and effect thinking is also what we call a higher level thinking skill. And that can be impacted by things our children have been exposed to. And the one that comes to mind is prenatal exposures to alcohol or drugs, which absolutely affects our children's ability for certain higher level thinking. Another lack that I think is important, because I hear this, not fortunately, not frequently, our lack of remorse and how it often plays out is a fear that parents have that this means that the child is evil, I mean, or a sociopath. And because we assume that remorse is something that is an emotion that good human beings have and bad human beings lack. So talk a little about the lack of remorse.
Yes, it's interesting. I've often found that remorse and empathy kind of develop at the same rate. And you're right. I hear a lot of parents saying to me, you know, he's evil, he's a sociopath, and because he's not sorry and he just looks me straight in the eyes and did it anyway. I can assure everybody, all my children did that, you know, and they're not sociopaths. So that's a good outcome. it really develops in a similar way, I think. And I think that sometimes, you know, we can feel sad for our children, and our children haven't had early on perhaps somebody feeling sorry for them or feeling sad for themselves, and they haven't felt, although they have felt sad, they haven't developed that remorse for something that they did, because a lot of their behaviours are survival based. So for example, if they're hungry and someone's left some food around, they're going to take it because they need it and they've eaten it. Are they going to feel sorry about doing that? No, they're not. Are they going to feel sorry that they've lied to you? No, they're not, because they've lied to you because they're worried that you might hurt them. So what we're seeing is a lot of survival strategies. So there's no space for remorse within that. And actually making a child say sorry is very unfulfilling as a parent, because you know that the child can just turn around and go, sorry. There's no meaning in that. There's no feeling that they are genuine. It actually makes us feel more angry.
It does.
Yeah.
I have actually then so responded, no, say it like you mean it, even though while I'm saying it, I think that is the most ridiculous thing any adult could ever say. So you're right, it makes me angry at that point. Yeah,
because we can't force it. We can't force it to happen because, you know, it's not there. It's not there. So I think the way I find really, really useful to think about that is, you know, I look at my 2-year-old grandson, for example. Does he have remorse? Well, sometimes there's a tiny, tiny little flash of it, but it's not really there just yet. So, but he's had 2 years of very good nurturing and good parenting. So if my son's 10, 11, 12, and we're trying to catch up, sometimes I would see him behaving in this way, and I'd look at him and I'd think, what age would I see that behavior? What age would I see a child hit another child and then be completely what I call unsorry, you know, nothing there at all, around, you know, coming up to 2. So I'd respond in the same way as I would to a 2-year-old, because emotionally I'm seeing, okay, that's where he is at the moment. He might be in a 10-year-old's body, but his brain is 2 at this moment in time. So let's respond to him as a 2-year-old. And with a 2-year-old, you're not going to sit there and say sorry like you mean it, because it would be ridiculous.
Yeah. And exactly, they don't have that capability. What about another thing that you identified as a cause for a reason why our children sometimes behave the way they do? A fear of being invisible. That one sounds so painful to me. It's almost poetically painful. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, sadly, you know, if you have a child that has been neglected, they have become invisible because their cries have gone unheard. They've often gone hungry, thirsty. They've might have slept where they fell, and they've been invisible to the outside world as well as their parents or carers. So they've been ignored. So their very survival depends on being seen. So my children, for example, who did experience very chronic neglect, would try to make sure that they stayed visible in a number of ways. And that was driven by their, what I call their base brain, their survival part of their brain. They weren't thinking it through. They weren't thinking, I know what I'll do. I'll talk loads of nonsense so that mum remembers I'm here. There's just kind of this automatic talking, or there's automatic stealing, or automatic kind of just talking, or being in front of me, or holding my leg, or knocking at the door when I'm in the bathroom. It's about, I'm still here, don't forget about me, because do you know what? Their survival part of their brain is saying, if you forget about me, I might die, because that's a reality for some of our children. You know, some of our children, and certainly in my own children's case, came very close to death because they were ignored and their needs weren't met. So it can be a very, very frightening place for them. So if we're on our phones and not looking at the child, or doing what we call in UK, as you call it, planned ignoring, it's an old parenting strategy which some people use for secure children. But planned ignoring is when you are planning to ignore the child, you're not looking at them and you're ignoring the bad behaviour. Well, that might work with a securely attached child, but with our children, it puts them straight back in the trauma room, and we see an escalation of the behaviours because they're scared that you've forgotten about them and they might die.
And, you know, you talked about if a child has been ignored or abused, their sense of self is one of worthlessness, and that translates into badness. So their internal working model might be, I am bad, I am unimportant, I am unlovable. So, I mean, a parent's reaction is to simply stress how much they love them, how lovable the child is. But you recommend that that's not necessarily the correct approach.
That's right. I learnt to my cost. I mean, I always say that I learnt everything I know from my children. And I learnt very quickly that if I praised my children, they were very uncomfortable with that, and it didn't fit in with their own view of themselves. Now, this goes against what we feel as parents, because what we want to do is we want to shower our children with love and with positivity and praise. But the problem is, if you've got a child who comes from a place of fear and worthlessness and dark, and then we shower them with light and praise and positivity, it's too much of a shock. And they literally will look at you and say, you're in their head, you're lying to me. I can't trust you. You don't know who I am. I'm going to kind of show you who I am, because I'm not feeling comfortable with what you're showing me. So what we did with the children and what we recommend is we, of course, we are positive with the children, but we base it in evidence and we keep it low level and consistent. So, for example, if my son brought home a picture he'd done from school and I had said, which I did in the early days, oh, what a lovely picture, that's brilliant, you know, let me put it on the wall, I'll show it to everybody. That's the quickest way to get him to tear it up or put it in the bin or scribble black over it. So what I do instead is say, that's an interesting picture, who's this in it? And I acknowledge that he's done it, and then I put it to one side. He can cope with that. He's still uncomfortable with that, but he can cope with that. If he does a good thing, I make sure that I evidence what he's done. So I wouldn't say, you're such a great boy, well done you. I would say, that was really kind when you helped Alfie yesterday. So I always put in reference points to where I'm giving them the praise.
And another reason that sometimes our kids behave the way they do, and I think this is so true, and if you think about it, there's so many examples of this. They're recreating a familiar environment, because even if it wasn't a good environment, familiar and familiarity is comforting. So
yeah.
Sometimes what our kids are doing is, even when they're doing, you know, trying to, you know, cause chaos and uproar, if that was all they ever knew was chaos and uproar, then that's something that they can deal with.
That's where they're comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. It's a comfort thing. All right.
Yes.
I want to move to talking about the first step is to try to understand why the child is doing what the child is doing.
We
also have to take it a step further. And the second thing you suggest is that we establish structure and firm boundaries. Well, you are preaching to the choir on that one, because I so believe that most of our kids, actually I think most kids, firmly attached or not, benefit from firm boundaries. But structure, I mean.
Yeah.
Well, firm boundaries too, but certainly structure. Let's talk some about the and I was appreciative that you made a comment that this is often misunderstood by people who are not parenting children who've experienced trauma, because we as parents come off looking rigid, perhaps even uncaring, which is nothing can be further from the truth.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes that people do mix up therapeutic parenting with what we call gentle parenting. And people used to say to me when I was parenting my children when they were younger, they would say that I was strict. They might say that I was too strict or too rigid, and because I had very firm routines and structure and boundaries. Now, what I knew, what I learned really fast, was that my children, having come from a place with no structure and no routine, needed to know where they stood. So in our house, no meant no. If I said no, that was it. I wasn't going to change it. Because if I did, if I moved that, it made my children feel unsafe. So every time, if I did anything like that, I would pay the price. So I learned really, really fast not to do that. So, for example, one of the things that happened in our house was that after the children had been with me for about a year, I was doing the usual things I do where I'm saying to them, you know, I've got their dinner out and they're all sitting at the table and it's very structured and, you know, this is what's happening now. And a friend of mine arrived and she worked with younger preschool children, and she said to me, "Oh, you know, you're really strict, aren't you? You're really, you know, really strict with them." And I said, "Oh, I tell you what, I'm a bit tired actually. You're right, I'm feeling tired. I'll go out for a couple of hours. You look after the children, and then I'll be back in 2 hours' time." So I left her with the children for 2 hours. When I came back, and this is absolutely true, the children were literally swinging on the curtains, bouncing on the beds, running riot. And my friend was sitting in the middle of the floor crying. And she said, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry." So I said to her, "Okay, tell me what happened." And she said, "Well, it was fine. I finished the dinner. And then we came and we got the stories out. And I said, would you like this story or that story?" Well, of course, I started laughing because I knew what would happen. Two children want this story, three children want that one. So then what's happened, unfortunately, she's recreated the sibling rivalry that happened in their birth family, where you could literally fight to the death because you might not get the last bit of bread. So they're fighting about who's going to get the story. And she really realised why at that point I had to be very, very clear with what was happening, why it was happening, and the fact that mum is in charge. Mum is the unassailable safe base, and what mum says goes. And I was very clear with that, and she never questioned that again. So that was great.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes it flies in the face of what our own natural instincts are. I tend to like being a fairly spontaneous person or a less rigid person. I say, well, no, and then I think about it, or the kid presents a good argument, and I think, okay, all right, we can, all right, you're right, we can do this, we, you know, we can change, yes, we can do, okay, tonight we can do, you know, washing our hair and then brushing our teeth, or whatever the structure is, and yeah. And that, I tend to be that way, and it, particularly for one of my children, I realized very early, that simply isn't going to work for her. She yeah. needs to that it, she didn't know where the boundary was, so she would have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing until it was a firm boundary, and that gave her a sense of security, and then things were fine. And I had to change, and what I did find after I forced myself to change was that our whole family functioned better. Turned out even I needed yeah. more structure than I realized. So yeah, and even and now I still provide structure for myself, because I find that even though my inclination is to not want to do it, to have the structure, I function better. But in particular, my children did.
Yeah.
Now I want to talk about. I was thankful that you. I am a person who works well with mnemonics or memory things, and I like to have takeaways. I like to have things that I can think of at the moment, because I tend to not think deeply in the middle of a crisis. So you this is, you don't call it this, but I call it a checklist. It's the acronym is PARENTS. I guess it's also a mnemonic. PARENTS.
Yes.
It's a model, but I think of it as a checklist that you can run through in your head in the moment before you respond. So walk us through what the each letter stands for in the PARENTS model.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, the very first thing so important in therapeutic parenting is you need to pause, because if you don't pause, you're not thinking straight. It's very easy to respond, react emotionally, and therapeutic parents need to respond consciously. Much easier said than done, I know. So, yeah, the P is for pause. Secondly, A is assess, where we all do this naturally. We do a little mini assessment of kind of what's going on and what's happening right now and what might have happened just before this to make it happen. We also have to see if there's any immediate danger, because if there is immediate danger, then we go, you know, straight away to move that. When we move to R, reflect, we're looking at what possible triggers there might have been. So, for example, if you've just switched the television off, it may be that that was the trigger to the behaviour. And I also try at that point to look at where the child is coming from. Now, all of those three things that I've just mentioned, pause, assess, reflect, could probably take anything from 1 to 10 seconds. We're not looking at a very long time frame here. E is empathise. Obviously, empathy underpins therapeutic parenting. So one of the things that's most effective is that we express empathy for what we see the child is experiencing right now. So we might say, I can see you're struggling with this, or I can see that, you know, it must be tough to feel that way. So we might do something like that to express empathy. Then what's also very useful is to use nurture. So sometimes that can be as simple as touching the child on the shoulder. It might be saying, come on, I'll make you a hot chocolate. Or it might even be as simple as just sitting down next to the child and staying present with them. Then T is think. So we tend to do thinking as the incident ends or as it finishes. We might think about, well, where did all that come from? How did I handle it? What could I have done differently? And is there something I can change to avoid this happening in the future? So, for example, if it's been triggered by switching the TV off, you might bring in a warning about the TV going off. And then finally, most importantly, is S for self-care. And that's around, you know, making yourself feel better, which lots of people forget, because we can't look after our children and meet their needs if we don't look after ourselves and meet our needs. And we're all quite bad at doing that, I think.
Yes, I agree. I think that self-care, self-nurturing is terribly overlooked. And I think that is almost especially the case the more troubled our kids are, the more we can slip into thinking we are the only ones who can deal with them. We are the only ones, or we can't afford to let anybody else. We have to be the ones doing everything. We don't want to disrupt their attachment to us, and this can even go, sadly, to if you're partnered to your partner and saying, well, you know, I'm the only one who understands the process, who knows our routines or whatever. So it's sometimes just giving ourselves permission to take care of ourselves.
Absolutely.
Is crucial.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are listening to an interview by Creating a Family with Sarah Naish. She is a therapeutic parent of five. She is the founder and CEO of the National Association of Therapeutic Parents, and she is the author of the new book, A to Z of Therapeutic Parenting Strategies and Solutions. We are now going to move into the practical application part, which is really the whole second half of the book. And what you do is literally take it A to Z, of very common everyday situations that adoptive and foster parents face, or actually all parents face, quite frankly, but we might face more of them. You break it down into what this behavior looks like. You know, this is an everyday, what does it look like? What could be some of the underlying causes, going back to one of the first things we want to do is understand the cause. So what could be some of the cause for our child doing this? Then you talk about preventative strategies, and then strategies in the middle, in the heat of the moment, and then strategies for afterwards. And all three of those, I think, are really important. So I want to start with, we have a very large online support group. And so it's easy for me to know what the big issues are because I know what people are complaining about or asking questions about. So one of the first ones is sleep issues. And that can be, from a practical standpoint, can look like any number of things. It can be a child not going to sleep, not able to settle down and sleep, or not willing to do that. A child who can't sleep during the night, or a kid who disrupts others in the night, or a kid who gets up very early, and oftentimes when they get up very early, they're disrupting others. So that's, you know, a real problem. Then kids who sleepwalk, or nightmares, or night terrors, or things like that. So the one thing I really want to focus on are, let's break it down to, let's say the settling down, the getting the child to sleep. Then we'll talk about the keeping them there.
Yeah.
All right, so let's say I've just described what it looks like. What could be some of the underlying causes for a child not wanting to go to bed, hesitating, fighting sleep, or just a bad behavior as bedtime approaches?
Okay, well, if we think about what we were saying earlier on, where, you know, about this fear of invisibility, where the children need to feel that you are holding them in your thoughts and holding them in mind. Otherwise, that, you know, they have a fear that they cease to exist and they something bad might happen to them. So one of the first problems is that when they go to bed, they are left alone, usually, and they are expected to then self-regulate, self-soothe, and fall asleep. Well, many of our children have never learned to fall asleep naturally. They've never learned to self-soothe or feel safe. So their bed or their bedroom may have been a very fear-inducing place, and being alone is going to be very frightening for them as well. So one of the things that we found with a lot of the children I've worked with over the years is that, and what they've expressed to me, is that it is this very moment of calm and silence that many of us as adults crave and look forward to that our children are unable to cope with, because it's at that moment when all is quiet and they are left alone that the memories resurface, the bad stuff, the trauma stuff comes back, and there's nowhere for them to go. They can't leave the room, they're not supposed to leave the room, and it can get bigger and bigger. So you know what it's like if you have a pain. If you have a pain and you go to bed and you're lying in bed at night, the pain feels bigger. If you get up and move around and you put the light on or watch TV or something, the pain fades into the background. So it's kind of a bit like that for our children with their memories as well. So we often see them unable to settle, being fearful of settling, and banging, shouting, calling out, constantly coming up and downstairs saying, I need a drink, or I need this. Or, but it's really about saying, I'm still here. Are you still here? Are you okay? Am I okay? So it's anything to keep that interaction going. And we see that in very young toddlers, but in our traumatized children, we'll see the same behaviors in much older children.
So what are some preventative strategies or some things that parents can think through? They've got a child who is struggling to go to bed, is not going to bed. Bedtime has become an issue every night. What are some things that parents can do from a practical standpoint that might help?
Well, one of the first things that I did was I took it right back and I looked at the, rather than my expectations around the chronological age of the child, I looked at what the children were actually behaving like. So, for example, my daughter, who was two, was really exhibiting behaviours of a child of around 6 months. And I knew that a child of 6 months would definitely have mum or dad in the room settling the child and being with them and staying with them. So one of the first things you do is you put back in parental presence. You stay with your child. And some of our children have never had that. Some of our children have never had a parent rocking them to sleep, soothing them, staying with them until they fall asleep. But it's very common with babies that we would do that. So if they've missed that stage out, you need to go through that stage. And I think that's really important to hold on to. If your child has missed out on a developmental stage, they can't move on until they've revisited it. So if you've got a child that can't settle at night because they're frightened, you go back to basics and you look at it and you say, okay, I think my child's acting the same as a six-month-old baby. How would I put a six-month-old baby to bed? What would I do? So one of the things that I used to do a lot was I used to simply stay in the room. So I would stay with my two of my children shared a room. So I would stay in that room. I might read a book to myself, you know, and if the children were unsettled, I'd just say, it's okay, mum's here. And I'd just sit there and carry on reading my book. So I'm not ignoring them, but I'm there and I'm the safety figure, and they could fall asleep more easily knowing that mum's in the room. And that's the kind of thing you're going to do with a much younger child normally. So that's one of the first things that we need to bring back in, really, for our children.
And some other suggestions that people have found helpful and that you mentioned as well. Weighted blankets for some children are quite helpful. The pop-up tents that you put over a child's bed, sometimes they look like camping tents, or they, you know, whatever. Sometimes they're in the form of like a car or whatever. But they're something it's over that sometimes adds a sense of security for a child. What are some others that you would parents can think about that might help?
Yeah, I mean, I just thought I'd mention, actually, interestingly, with the pop-up tent that you put over their bed, when my son grew up, when he was an adult, he said to me that the reason the pop-up tent helped him was because when he was lying in bed, he used to be able to see and imagine frightening faces and shadows in the corner of the room. But having the pop-up tent meant that he could easily see the corners of the tent, so there was no horrible shapes in the corner of the room. If you stroke the child's face, especially their cheeks, like you would instinctively with a baby often, that increases the delta waves in the brain, which actually induces sleep. So if your child will allow you to do that, and you're able to do that, then stroking their face can really help them as well. I know that in the USA you can get melatonin, and it's fairly widely used. In the UK you can't. So we always use bananas and milk, which we can't. We're not allowed. We're not trusted to buy it. I don't know why. We have a lot of interesting ideas like that in the UK. But we can give the children melatonin in bananas and milk. So we give them bananas and milk at bedtime, and that's a natural source of melatonin. That really helps them to go to sleep as well. So another thing that people use, and I've really had some very good results with it, is a dream pad, and it's like a vibrating pillow, and it can also play sleep-inducing sounds for the children. And that really helps them to go to sleep too. So some of those things are quite good. Oh, and I also did do a recording of me reading a bedtime story, because you know how sometimes our children want the same story over and over and over again. And on the basis that we do need to look after ourselves as well. So I made a CD with me reading the story, and they would then sit there and listen to that on, or watch a DVD with me reading the story. So that helps them too to settle.
All right, so now what are some strategies for the little darling who not only wakes up in the middle of the night, but wakes others up in the middle of the night, including ourselves, myself, let me be frank. Some strategies for, you've given strategies for getting them in bed, but what about keeping the little boogers in bed?
My son used to wander about quite a bit and go off into his sister's rooms. And what we did is we put alarms under the carpet outside the bedroom doors, which we would switch on at night, so that if somebody left their room, that it would make a sound like a doorbell, like ding dong. So we'd know, because they were all slightly different, we would know which child had left the room. So we'd be able to go very quickly to return them back to bed and then, do the whole thing all over again that we would normally do for settling the child. So alarms are quite useful, I think, for that. Also, a two-way baby monitor, if you can bear it. A two-way baby monitor is quite good because, again, as soon as the child gets up to leave the room, you know they've done it. And you can also, without having to rush up the stairs, you can say, I can see what you're doing, back into bed now. And often your voice is enough to help the child to go back into bed. So we try to kind of nip that really early in the bud. It's a useful thing to be able to do, because of course what the child is doing is they're going off to try to wake people up to be with them and to be friends with them. So some of the things that I would do, for example, if the doorbell's gone off and I've heard the child, I'd go down, I'd see them, and I'd say, come on, back to bed, go back with them, and I'd stay with them. And that's the hardest thing. It's the staying and getting them back into that habit, or starting the habit even, for staying put in their bed and bed being a safe place. Sometimes I'd help the child to distract them, and I'd let them listen to music, especially some nice mindfulness tapes, so they could listen to that as well. But it's not the time to have a big fight. It's not the time to. It's not a good idea to turn around to them. What are you doing out of your bed? Get back right now! If you do that, the child's cortisol levels will spike. Their fight flight will come in, and you'll end up
you
with
won't
a
be able to go back
tantrum.
You're totally awake. And if the child is not waking somebody and just goes and. One of my children would go and sleep at the foot of our bed, not on the bed, but on the floor. And that was fine. He was not waking anyone, and he would get up in the middle of the night and do that. And he continued until he was probably 12 or 13, and then he stopped. And I know other children who will go and get in a twin bed, in a sibling's room or something. It's the waking up of the whole household that becomes a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that happens
and
not only in the...
real sure...
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry.
No,
I was going to say,
ahead.
The only surefire way of preventing that is using parental presence and staying with them. And whether that's... I always recommend that you are staying with them in the child's room and, you know, you're not going to end up with a 13-year-old sleeping in your bed with you because then you're going to have no life. But, you know, when they're little, it's easy to get into that. So... But, yeah, parental presence, it's a surefire way. It's a long job, I understand that, but it is the only way to make them feel safe.
And just briefly, the waking up in the middle of the night is one thing, but waking up early is, I think, even more common where children whose bedtime, I mean, wake-up time is set at 5 o'clock, and that means that it's just killing from the parent's standpoint because they're not getting in bed in time. So any strategies for our early wakers?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's as simple as them being hungry. So, again, if you adjust your thinking to a toddler, to like when you're trying to get your toddlers when they're coming out of babyhood and they start sleeping through the night and you explore all these different strategies of how you might get them to stay asleep for a bit longer. So, for example, you might put a bottle of milk next to their cot or their bed, so that they, if they wake up and they're hungry, they might have some milk and they might then fall back off to sleep for another half an hour to an hour. You can introduce that kind of thing. So I would put drinks of milk. I mean, with my children, I would put bottles of milk because they've missed out on that stage. They haven't had that nurture stage with bottles. So I would leave bottles of milk at the side so that if they woke up early, they would often have that. Obviously, milk has melatonin in. It's going to help them feel a bit sleepy. So that's one of the things that we would do. I'd also keep some certain special toys that they would like to have that they didn't see very often. And there would be a specific time of day when they would have them. And that was, do you know what? If you wake up early, if you're really quiet, you can play with it just for a little while, you can have this. So my child, one of them, he really loved this little football game. So we used to put that in his room after he'd gone to sleep. And if he woke up, the only time of the day he was then playing with that was if he woke up very early. So he used to play with that quite quietly in order to not wake us up so that he could play with it for longer. So that was useful. The other thing is that our children, when they wake up, they often have high levels of cortisol because they've been lying still all night, so their energy levels and cortisol levels have spiked. So we can help them by producing a little snack. So as I said, milk is good, but again, a biscuit or a banana, something like that, can help them too. So I think that it's important that we understand that whatever we do, it does take a long time. There's not a quick fix. If a child is in a strategy, is in a kind of a way of thinking where they're going to wake up early and they're going to come and see if mum or dad is okay, then that's difficult. And I would just be going back to bed and staying with them. It's not waking up time yet. You know, we have a thing called grow clocks here. I don't know if you use them, but they're great. And they have stars on them. And then when it gets to waking up time, the sun comes out and the child knows that it is actually time to get up. And my children would respond quite well to that kind of thing as well. So those are helpful.
We have something like that. Exactly. We have something, there are different brands that will give your child.
Yeah.
And I think that is important as well. Practically letting them know it's okay to come in and look and make sure mommy and daddy are here, but then very quietly go back, tell them what they can do. Yes, you can come when you wake up, but unless the sun's up, on the clock, then you walk very quietly back to bed and get back in bed, that type of thing. All right, another very common issue that parents face, particularly with children, have been adopted or fostered at an older age and have experienced trauma in their youth, is bathroom issues, both urination and defecation. And these are really hard for parents to deal with. There's kind of the ick factor. And there's also the worry about, oh, man, the whole house is going to smell. And also you just it's frightening in a way, and particularly the poo issues. You know, it's like this is just. This is wetting, wetting the bed is one thing, but this, so let's talk first of all what some of these issues would look like. And I'm going to talk about, of course, wetting the bed and daytime wetting are some of the urination issues. Some of the defecation issues is a child who poos on themselves or has a BM and seems unaware of it, or a child who has a BM in their pants and is aware of it but doesn't seem concerned, or a child who has a BM in their bed or in their or goes into a corner or a particular place in the house and has it rather than going in on the toilet. So things such as that, and then children who will play in their bowel movement, which is not uncommon with an infant, but it isn't common with a child who is at an older age. So what let's focus, I think, for the purposes of talking here, let's start with what I actually think is perhaps the harder issue, and that is the BM, the BM or the poo issues, however you want to say it.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what are some of the causes for this? Let's start with that.
Yeah.
Why would a child, and I guess one question would be, has the child ever been successfully potty trained? I guess that's the first question.
Yeah.
If they've never been
potty
trained with number two, then that's one issue. But so let's talk about that. Let's say you have a 5-year-old who has never been potty trained.
Yeah. Yeah, if a 5-year-old hasn't been potty trained, then you're going to have exactly the same issues you would have with an 18-month-old, 2-year-old child that you were trying to potty train, except they've been doing that for 5 years. So it's much more entrenched. And unfortunately, if the child has got to five, they may well have lost any sense of shame. So one of the big factors that helps in potty training a younger child is they see around them that the other children are starting to change, and they start to develop a sense of shame about what's going on in their body, and they start modifying their behaviour. But if a child's got to five, they've usually then developed some kind of coping strategy around the fact that they poo themselves, that they wet themselves and that kind of thing. So they've normalised it. So it's much more difficult to start potty training a 5-year-old than it is a 2-year-old because of that reason. When we talk about shame as well, they also obviously have normal shame around bodily functions, and it just depends. It's interesting sometimes to see how our children, if they are very open about it or if they're trying to conceal it. Lots of parents have issues where the child will poo and they will hide it, and they'll find it in all kinds of bizarre places. The most bizarre place I ever heard was a child who had pooed in the back of a chair and zipped it up and saved around 3 months' worth of feces in the back of a zip-up chair. So the poor foster parent knew there was a dreadful smell and could not find where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So the child there was hiding it because of the shame that they'd experienced. They'd been taught that this was bad and it shouldn't happen. So, you know, rather than putting it in the toilet, they were hiding it.
Yeah, exactly. We should start by saying, obviously, the first thing you're going to do is make certain that there isn't a medical issue. I should have begun with
that.
Yeah. Make sure that this is an emotional issue, not a medical issue. So if a child if your concern is that a child has never really been properly potty trained, then you're going to go back to the very beginning and be very patient, because it's going to take you considerably longer because you've got a much more established, and the child has come up, as you point out, with coping techniques for doing it. So that is if a child has never been potty trained. Go back to some of the basic potty training methods that you would use with a 2 or 3-year-old and apply them, and just knowing that it's going to take a long time. What about if a child starts? Sometimes, quite frankly, if a child comes to an older age, you don't 100% know whether the child has ever been dry or clean throughout the day. But assuming that you think that they have been and they have started, what would be some of the things that you would go through your head about causes? Why would a child who had been dry or potty trained it loses that ability or is no longer? What are some of the reasons
sometimes
you would go through your head?
Sometimes I think that this is around it's about the child trying to get us to reject them. So, for example, although my eldest child would do things like be rude and defiant, one of my other children would poo themselves or wet themselves, and it was about keeping them away, keeping adults away. You know, don't connect to me, don't attach to me, I am unlovable. Literally, you know, look at me, I'm covered in poo, there's poo everywhere, I'm unlovable. One of my foster children, because I fostered many years ago, one of my foster children, when they were grown up, who used to wet the bed all the time, said to me, if I wet the bed, my dad wouldn't come and get me in the night. So it was used as a defense mechanism. So if there's something that's triggered that, and if there's a fear, and even the fear of attaching can trigger the child pooing or weeing in ways that haven't happened that you've seen so far. So ironically, sometimes this can be a positive thing, or the underlying, it doesn't feel positive, I know, but the underlying emotion can be a positive thing because the child feels a connection and feels like attachment is happening. And then this internal working model says, no, no, I'm bad, I'm worthless, I'm not lovable. Look, I'll show you how bad I am. That's not done in a thinking kind of way. It's done in an instinctive way. Keep away from me. Look, I'm bad. I'll show you how bad I am. Because our instinct is to draw away from that because it repulses us. So it's the strongest way the child can use to try to make us reject them.
And, you know, and it's also the one thing that a child can totally control. You as a parent, I mean,
yes.
So it is a control. I am in charge of when I poo and when I pee, period. Nobody else can be in charge of that. So there is a control thing. And quite frankly, from a parent standpoint, it's important to realize you are not in control. You cannot force your child. So that's, you know, when you decide how you're going to handle it, there's not a thing that you can do that's going to be. And, you know, the other thing that I think of is you would talk about our children often have this lack of cause and effect. I mean, most people realize that bowel movements smell. Therefore, if I poo in this chair and zip it up and hide it, it's going to smell and it's going to get caught. But our kids may not.
Yeah.
I mean, they may have gotten used to the smell of urine and poo, and so they're not going to necessarily notice it. But number two, the whole idea that, okay, if I hide it here, I'm going to get found. If I just go to the bathroom, it's not, you know, a big deal. And that's not what they're thinking at the moment.
No, that's right. And it's interesting you say about, you know, not smelling it to them. It doesn't smell. So, for example, if you think of your babyhood smells, or, you know, if you have had a birth child and that you've had that experience or looking after a baby, you know, the smells around that baby are around certain types of talcum powder, around the shampoo that you might be using, that, you know, and when we smell that as adults, it can feel like a nice safe smell. Well, the smells that were around my children when they were little in their birth parents' house was urine, feces, dog feces. Those were their babyhood smells. So that became really the kind of canvas on which their lives started. So therefore, when there are now in their room, perhaps smells of poo and pee and all those kinds of things which make us recoil, my children would look at me and say, what? Because to them, it's just the canvas from which everything starts. They're not really conscious of it. So I think that that's really important. And also, some of my children were unaware of the physical sensation. So just like I explained earlier about how they've missed out on that physical sensation around hunger, the triggers around hunger, they've also missed out on the triggers around, I need the toilet. So that can be missing completely.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not getting the same urges that we would expect them to have.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, the other really important point is if you've got a child from a background of extreme neglect, their only toy might have been poo. They might literally have had nothing else to play with other than what came out of their body. So that's really important to remember.
And that I was going to go back to the inability to notice it. It's not that they aren't aware when they're actually urinating or defecating. That they do know that oftentimes. But what they're not aware of are the feelings and the urges that come up. And it's especially the case if they're doing something they enjoy. They're watching TV or they're playing or something. So they're not, whereas people who are potty trained, they sense the need earlier. And as that need grows, it overcomes our desire, that person's desire to continue to read the book or play with the game or whatever. And I think that a lot of young children often just simply don't want to stop what they're doing, and the urge has to be great before they will. And if you're not recognizing that urge until the last minute, then you've waited too late. And oftentimes our children, even though they are chronologically at an age where most children would sense this, that emotionally and developmentally, they're at a much younger age. So they're at the age of, whereas we expect a three-year-old to go running to the potty holding themselves because they've waited too late, we don't expect that of a seven-year-old or eight-year-old or 10-year-old. So there's some developmental things there as well. All right, now let's talk about some practical, preventative, and minimizing strategies that parents can use for this really difficult issue.
Mm. Well, like you say, first of all, we do like to rule out the medical side of it. I have to say, in my professional experience over very many years, what tends to happen is sometimes it's over-medicalized, and a lot of the times when you've got a child from trauma, the root is in trauma. So although we are obviously looking at medical issues, that is the case in a small number of cases, really. Like you say, first of all, we're going to definitely look around their chronological age and their actual emotional age, and we need to respond to what we're seeing. And what we would see is that child potty trained. At what age would the child be doing that? Would that be 2.5? That kind of thing. So if they're holding on to poo, for example, what I would do is I would tell them. So if their body isn't giving them the right signals, sometimes you can start seeing it. So, for example, when you're talking earlier about how they don't want to leave an activity, you might notice the child is dancing about. Now, normally when we're potty training a child, we might say, I think you need the toilet. Well, we need to bring in all that kind of thing again for our older children that are older chronologically, but they're dancing about. We see some things, or they might be clenching, or maybe their face tone changes. So we say to them, we don't say, importantly as a therapeutic parent, we don't say, do you need the toilet? We say, oh, it's toilet time, off we go, and you go. You don't ask the child if they need it, you tell them. For example, in my book, I say, I've noticed that when you're playing with a Lego and you don't want to leave it, sometimes you do a little shiver as your body is trying to hold the poo in. So that's why you're getting tummy ache. So every time this happens, I'm going to keep your toy safe and take you to the toilet. Because, of course, the children are worried that if they leave that toy, someone's going to take it. So, we do need to be very clear that although they need to leave the toy to go to the toilet, we're going to keep that toy safe, and we need to explicitly say that to them and tell them. We also, and I did this a lot with one of my children, we recreated playing with poo. Obviously, I couldn't actually bring myself to do that, and I'm not suggesting that parents do that, but we did make up quite nice gooey mixtures with chocolate and flour and cake mixture and that kind of thing. And while the children are playing with that, and you can talk about it, and you can talk about, this feels a lot like playing with poo, doesn't it? And, and I wonder if so, and it tastes a bit nicer. So I think that gradually what I found was when my child who had an issue with poo, and that was because he certainly had that as a toy when he was very, very little, we got some kind of brown Play-Doh and brown plasticine, and we had all kinds of things that he could play with. So he was recreating that sensory stimulation that he needed, so we replaced it.
You talk about, and that's a good one, and actually there are some, if you're worried about how to find brown Play-Doh, there are some wonderful recipes for homemade Play-Doh, super easy. And actually, you can use whatever food coloring you want to make it whatever color you want.
Yeah.
You talk about making a game out of the amount of BM the child does. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that if the child is having a big poo or a little poo, we used to have little competitions. Sounds quite funny, but if they're rushing back, so obviously we don't do reward charts. I mean, we don't use reward charts in anything, but sometimes we would give a little treat depending on the size of their poo. So one of the things we did, which my children really liked, is that because they were five siblings, they were very competitive. So they would have little competitions to see who could do the biggest poo, and they would have different names. So if the bowel movement was a certain size, it might be called Horace, and if it was a very small one, it would be called something else like Cynthia. And they would really enjoy this whole kind of horrible conversation around, oh, you know, I did a Horace and you only did a Cynthia, and it became like a bit of a competition for them and a fun thing. But what was good about that was it took away any shame element around it, and it became like a funny thing to talk mm-hmm. about, which is better than them holding on to it all and becoming ill, or you know, you going into the room and the whole room is covered in it. So although it sounds a little bit extreme, helping your children kind of have these conversations and competitions, it's you can deal with that later on. You can gradually bring that down. And as they get older, say, well, you know, it's our own little family code for that, and we're not going to do that. And I would also provide different types of treats depending on it. So I might say something like, I have to be very clear about this. I wouldn't say if you do a poo, you will get so and so. So it'd be done spontaneously. So I might say, wow, you know, that's quite a big poo in the toilet. I think you must have a bit of space in your tummy now, actually. You might be a bit hungry. So then I'd give them something. So in effect, although they're having a reward for going in the right place, it being in the toilet, you know, I'm not saying, wow, that's really great, you have a reward. I'm saying you might be a bit hungry now because you've got a bit of space in your tummy. So I'd frame it in that kind of way.
Okay. We have probably run this into the ground as far as discussing. But it's a real issue for families. And I think that one of the things that happens is that not many people are facing a five-year-old who is having a BM in the corner. So you don't – whereas mm-hmm. if you're talking about a three-year-old, plenty of people are having that experience. So it feels like a normal experience for a mom of a two- or a three-year-old. It doesn't feel like a normal experience of a mom of a five- or a six- or a seven-year-old. So normalizing the experience for us and understanding the underlying cause and giving some creative ideas for working around and realizing that it's not going to be an immediate, this is not something that's going to be cured immediately. There are so many things in your A to Z resources that I am really anxious to talk about because so many of them are real things that we experience. We are running out of time, unfortunately. So let me bring up one that I knew this would happen, by the way. I absolutely knew as I was reading the book. I went, dadgummit, I've got a huge list.
Well, it
here.
Kind of replicates me writing the book, to be honest, because when I started writing it, I thought, well, I'll just do a little overview, and then there's about 20 behaviors, and then, of course, there were 60-odd. So
yeah, exactly. As you keep adding, you're going, oops, got to add this one. Oops, got to add this one.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about one that I think is so it's so common and so seldom talked about, and that is children whose behavior, well, we often call it sabotaging, holidays. The oftentimes we find that our support group gets really tense in the month of December, and I have attributed to the tenseness is because everybody's kids are tense, and it's almost as if there are some children who need to sabotage the holiday coming up, and then parents often just get angry because it feels like everything is being ruined, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling cycle. So, all right, let's use your approach, and I've just described what it can look like. Let's use your approach. So what are some of the reasons that a child might become either more anxious or sabotage or act out or whatever, whatever way we want to describe it, around a holiday time?
Well, first of all, you know, it's a transition, it's a change, and any change can provoke a fear response in our children. Just this last weekend, I went away for a weekend with my two-year-old grandson, and on the journey there, he was horrible and really kind of pushing his luck with everything, and on the way back, he was the same. But when we were there, he was fine, but he's two. But we see that in our children because it's a fear of change and fear of transitions. They don't really know where they're going, what's going to happen, and where's my bed, and what's happening with that. So we do see that lack, and there's a lack of structure. The structure changes, especially when you're approaching Christmas, birthdays. The day changes, different things happen. Any change is frightening for our children. So what we see a lot of is the fear-based responses.
And I think that sometimes we as parents are looking at the holiday as an opportunity for a break from some of the routine, the structure. And so we're thinking in our heads, okay, you know, they're not in school, we're on holiday, we've got, you know, relatives coming over, we don't need to have, you know, bedtimes will slide, breakfast routines will not be, you know, and expectations of chores won't be there because it's the holiday. And I think that for some kids is very dysregulating.
It is indeed. And we always kept our routine absolutely clear. So it was a bit of a shame because, like you say, you know, you want to be able to be a bit spontaneous. But in the end, I realized that my life would be much easier and the children would feel much more secure if I kept everything the same. So I'm not saying that, you know, for example, on a school day, we'd be getting up at 7:30 and that's what we would do. So on a holiday day, we'd be getting up maybe at 8 o'clock, but that would be the holiday time. So we would be able to move things slightly, but we had a very strong holiday structure and routine. So we would get up at 8 o'clock, but we'd have the same breakfast, we'd have the same snack time, we'd have the same lunch time. And then we would go out in the afternoon between that time and that time. So we had a very clear holiday structure. And we also used to have very visible planners so the children could see what was happening, who was going where, and what was going next. Because if there's this whole kind of blankness of the next 2 weeks and nobody really knows what's going to happen, all that does is provoke fear in our children. One of my friends that I work with who grew up in care said that when it was the holiday time, she was always moved in the holidays. That's when she was moved foster placement. So she would look at the calendar, she'd look at those two empty weeks, and she'd think, I wonder what day they're going to move me. So that's something we've got to really think about with our children, about, you know, what are they thinking? Do they think they're going to still be with us at the end of the holiday? And we need to be very explicit about that. So if there's a planner there showing what they're doing on day 14, that means they know they're going to be there on day 14.
Mm-hmm. Plus, it gives them an idea going back to the structure and the routine. It gives them an idea of okay, I'm not going to be going to school, then I'm coming home, but this the day has... I do know that if I look there, I can see that, oh, I'm going to, our TV time today is going to be at X time. And then we're going to go to the park at tomorrow or whatever there is they can do. Okay, some other practical things that we can do over the holidays that would be, and by holiday, I don't necessarily mean summer. I'm speaking of actual holidays. What are some other, the having a planner, that's a great idea that where children can see it. What about building up, what about the anticipation of a holiday? I mean, all the business, if you're a Christian or if you celebrate Christmas, all the anticipation of Santa Claus and all the what's going to be the gift for this entire week, our evenings are going to be different. So,
interestingly, you talk about Christmas because last year, on our Facebook page, we had absolutely hundreds of people saying Christmas was a nightmare, Christmas was very difficult.
We had all these issues.
Where, you know, and I thought, oh, yeah, that takes me back, you know, where you've got people saying, if you're not good, Santa won't come, and all those kinds of stupid
Elf
things
on the
which
shelf.
Don't
I don't
help
know if you guys
us.
Have Elf on the Shelf who's always hiding and watching.
We're not having it. We're bringing out in the National Association this year, we're bringing out some posters which has got some of our characters in from our children's book. One's called William Wobbly, and it says, William Wobbly says, Father Christmas always comes to this house, no matter what. So that's our version of Elf on the Shelf, you know. But interestingly, because last year we had so many, and I thought, oh, yeah, this happened. Yeah, this happened. The children used to sabotage Christmas. I'd get them what they wanted, and then they'd be broken. So I've just finished writing The Very Wobbly Christmas. It's a strategy dressed up as a book, a children's book, and it really goes through all those things. It's got all the things that go wrong, the silly people saying the children, if they're not good, Father Christmas won't come, breaking their presents, not being able to cope with all the presents, the lack of routine, the school plays. It's got all of those in it, and then how we kind of overcome that. It's about keeping everything as familiar as possible and explaining things, because we know what's happening, and we often assume that our children do, but we haven't told them. So it's a really good idea to sit down with them and say, on this day, this is happening. And you know what? If you don't want to do the school play, you don't have to do it. I would say as well, and I know this is difficult, and I know that Christmas and holidays are a time for visiting and seeing family. If your children can't cope with it, stay at home. Stay at home with them. Keep them in their routine. Go and visit another day, because otherwise you're piling expectation on expectation and pressure on yourself, because you take your child, you're hoping it's all going to be okay, and then people are looking at you sideways saying, well, you need to toughen up, or something unhelpful to you. So give yourself a break by keeping it low key.
Yeah, that's really good advice, and really sometimes hard advice, and that is because we feel like we're going to, we may not feel like we will be disappointed. So that's kind of the reality check that we parents can sometimes do, which is, all right, realistically, is my child going to be able to handle 3 days at the grandparents' house with all the cousins there? Or is this going to be a situation that's setting not only my child up for failure, but for me as well? Because my sister is going to be judgmental. My mother is going to think that she needs to spoil them, and whatever. Sometimes just being realistic, and also thinking of some things that, okay, then acknowledging your own disappointment. I'm going to be disappointed. So what is something that I could look forward to? And perhaps the day after Christmas, if they live closely, I can go to my parents' house by myself with my partner, a husband, keeping the children. And it may only be for 4 hours, but I'm still going to get, you know, maybe that's it. And then your husband can go to his family. Just being creative about, okay, and acknowledging I'm going to be disappointed, but, and this won't be forever, but for this year, I need to think in terms of what's in my child's best interest, and quite frankly, what's in my best interest, because if my kid is really acting out, it's going to ruin it for me either way, so I might as well be ruined with the child not being involved. Anyway.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Sarah Naish, for talking with us today about parenting, therapeutic parenting. Sarah Naish is the author of the A to Z book of therapeutic parenting, or it's actually the A to Z of therapeutic parenting, Strategies and Solutions. If you have enjoyed this book and you want to get more information, Sarah, where can they find more information about you and your organization?
Well, the best place to go to is www.naotp.com. That's the National Association of Therapeutic Parents. That will hook you into everything we're doing. Obviously, you can get all the books, including all the children's books, on Amazon and from our publisher, which is Jessica Kingsley Publishing. But I think they're more or less kind of everywhere mainstream. But those are the best places to start. And we have a Facebook page called Therapeutic Parenting. So you're welcome to pop along and see us on that as well.
Thank you so much. Let me remind everybody that this show and all the resources provided by Creating a Family could not and would not happen without the generous support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to adoptive and foster parents. One of our wonderful partners is Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a Hague-accredited international adoption agency placing children from around the world, and they also do kinship adoptions. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE Appliances top load washer and dryer pair with deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and four precise water levels, just $478 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. Gas dryer extra. See store for details. Valid through April 17th.